Hello, I'm Linda Huey, and this is Meet the Doctors, the show that lets you hear what doctors have to say about their lives, their work, their passions, and what they foresee for the future. Today, we'll meet spine surgeon Sanjay Khurana, whose father left Northern India for a scholarship to study engineering at the University of Southern California. Our guest, Dr. Khurana, is now CEO of DISC in Marina del Rey, California. This episode of Meet the Doctors is brought to you by Complete PT Pool and Land Physical Therapy. Whether you're trying to prevent knee surgery or recovering from shoulder, hip, or back pain, Complete PT offers you the most advanced pool therapy in combination with traditional land therapy. You don't need to know how to swim or even get your hair wet. The 92-degree saltwater pool soothes joints and muscles and helps reduce pain immediately. Visit CompletePT.com. That's CompletePT.com. Now let's meet spine surgeon Dr. Sanjay Khurana. We're here today at DISC in Marina del Rey with orthopedic spine surgeon Dr. Sanjay Khurana. I want to welcome you to Meet the Doctors.
Thank you.
We'll get back to DISC eventually, but I'd like to start with how did you get to here? Now, you were born and raised in Southern California.
Right. I was born not too far from here in Mar Vista.
Very close.
Yes.
And you lived here until you were seven.
Yes, I lived here till I was about seven, almost eight, exactly.
And then your father got a job in the Middle East. And where did you go? And what was that like?
So my dad is a engineer, a civil, industrial, and electrical engineer. And so he was wearing a lot of engineering hats. And at that time, late 70s, early 80s, he was offered kind of a lifetime dream job, which was to take a job in the Middle East for an American company called Parsons, which is based out here in Pasadena. And he was involved in the infrastructure build out of the emerging cities in the country of Saudi Arabia.
So that was in what decade was that?
Yeah. This was early 80s.
Early 80s.
So we're talking about 81, 82.
And that's when everything was starting to explode there with building up the big cities.
Exactly. And specifically, the pipeline that they're building to take oil from the Persian Gulf and bring it all the way across the country to protect it from invaders. So they parked it close to the Red Sea.
Yeah.
And so we lived in a small town called Yambu.
Which I've never heard of before, but what a great name.
It's interesting. It's more expatriates, more Americans and Europeans than Saudis.
Really? So what was your childhood like from, you were there for how long?
So I was there from roughly 8 years old to about 14 years old. And so it's an international compound. There's gates that you can't get into unless you have permits, and it's a lot of security and so forth. Like I said, it's a highly, it's very popular, a lot of expatriates. So a lot of Americans, a lot of Europeans, Koreans, Indians, Filipinos, and they constituted the worker base for building up that industrial complex. And they had an international school, which was primarily composed of American teachers, and it was basic American school. We had curriculum, we had PE, we had recess, extra educational, you know, activities. I swam a lot out there, starting my passion for swimming. But it was just, as far as I'm concerned, it was just like any other place in the world to go to school.
So why didn't you stay there for decades?
So that wasn't up to me. That was up to the government.
Ah.
The government doesn't allow foreigners to have children stay there after ninth grade.
Oh, so that was when you had to come back.
Exactly. So they actually pay, the company pays for schooling overseas.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an opportunity to, get my higher education elsewhere. That was ninth grade that I finished up in that city of Yambu. So I had to go to high school.
Sure.
And so I ended up going to boarding school in New Jersey. I had uncles and aunts who lived out there, so that was kind of fun. It was a private school. I swam. I did track. I played a little tennis. Made a lot of great friendships.
I think you're being modest because I read that you also competed in the Junior Olympics in swimming.
Yes, I did that. In fact, that was on the heels from the Middle East. I was on the Middle East travel squad for the U.S. Junior Olympics. And it was interesting. I was definitely a standout swimmer in my little community, and I did well in the Junior Olympics. But then when I went to my high school, it was a completely different environment. I mean, these were Olympic caliber swimmers, and I didn't anywhere succeed anywhere close to as well as I did in the Middle East. It was a much smaller community. But it did introduce me to the world of, you know, once you're out of your provincial area of schooling and you're kind of welcome to the big world, you just get it's an awakening. And I think it also stirred up my competitive juices, not just in athletics, but just in terms of everything. And so now I want to be back in California.
That was
the next thing. I really want to be back in California. When I got into Cal Berkeley, it was just a proposition at that time I couldn't turn down. It was the best public school in the country. Great education. I was back in California. It was close enough that I was close to home, but far enough that, you know, I had my own independence.
Well then, okay, so you moved from there to Stanford Medical School.
Right. For my personality, I just felt I was number one. I think I was a little bit more technically minded, and I like to see outcomes, you know, blossom much more rapidly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why orthopedics as a broad field, and in fact, spine surgery as a subspecialty within that field really appealed to me. Even in my rotations as a medical student, I just saw such amazing outcomes of people being just profoundly debilitated coming in, you know, on a Monday and literally leaving the hospital on a Wednesday, high-fiving and just dancing.
Tell me one story that is one that kind of lit you up.
So some of the more dramatic ones in my residency, if you fast forward a few years from medical school, there certainly are share of trauma and
car accidents,
motorcycle accidents, and a lot of
bullets.
Bullets occasionally, but gunshot wounds were not infrequent. But I think one of the more vivid memories of intervention that I had was a young man who came in after a motorcycle rollover. Who was literally partially paralyzed. He had a syndrome called a central cord syndrome. It's a little bit uncommon in the younger population.
What is that syndrome?
So it's when the upper extremities are more adversely affected from a neurological standpoint compared to the lowers.
Usually you think of forever the injury is everything below that is what's
it's a paradoxical lesion. So it was a young individual, and it was a trauma, and I think I remember as a resident looking into his eyes, because he wasn't much younger than I was, and just looking into the fear in his eyes and just the incapacitation, the uncertainty, the just the anxiety. And just, I remember calmly, the attending I was working with really had a good handle of not just the injury, but the clinical presentation, and was able to give this patient just a lot of really good counseling about what to expect, how likelihood of him recovering. And with a cautious optimism, we proceeded with surgery, and he woke up with immediate improvement in his upper extremity strength. And literally like a day or perhaps 2 days later, he was out and into rehab. And this is just one of, I'd say, dozens of stories, you know, in my training where just the outcomes are so dramatic and so reinforcing that it really validated my choice. Because by that time, by, you know, mid-residency, I'd already chosen a pathway of subspecialization.
And then why did you choose the University of Miami for your fellowship? Or did they choose you, or you both chose each other, I assume?
Right. So the fellowship training programs are a match. So you submit your top two or three choices. They submit their top one to three choices. And then just like residency, you match. You know, for me, I think the way I looked at my training was that I had this kind of ivory tower training at Stanford, and you know, I had the luxury of being able to really have a reasonable lifestyle, to really see a good diversity of patients. But I don't think my residency, I was really tortured the way some people talk about their training programs.
I've heard some people say that it's like boot camp or SEAL training.
Yeah, I certainly worked hard. I don't deny that, but I enjoyed everything about my training. I wanted to do something that was hard. I wanted to go somewhere where there was trauma, a lot of trauma, that we'd be working hard for 1 year. And Miami had the reputation at the time under the guidance of a physician in chief named Frank Isamont, who just had a great reputation in terms of being an educator, a surgeon, a leader. And I handpicked that program. That was my top choice. And fortunately, I believe he handpicked me. So it worked out very well. And I got to say, that was the first year that I actually worked really hard. because it required waking up early, required teaching the residents about spine medicine, learning at the same time learning yourself.
So you're sort of an intermediary. You're being a fellow, which means you're learning from them, but at the same time you're teaching the residents.
Correct. You're right.
That's an interesting position.
You're trying to glean as much in that subspecialty, but also giving pearls and nuggets to the residents who are counting on you as a intermediary between their attending and the patient. So I think the one thing that I'll take from that fellowship more than anything, because techniques change and so forth, is just how to be to put the patient first. And, you know, if you put the patient first, fundamentally, that's what you're doing in practice. You're putting the patient front and center. You're giving him the depth of your knowledge and your experience and your expertise.
Yeah.
And these patients who are entrusting you with their lives, you're giving them everything. A lot of things in spine we can handle. There's a lot more we can't handle. And I think realizing what our limitations are is very important. And I think being able to put that in a professional way was something I'll take from fellowship.
Stay tuned for more of this interview with Dr. Khurana right after this. If you're in the market for a bike, you want to buy your bike from a shop that has great service. Bicycles need to be serviced and maintained on a regular basis for safety. You want a relationship you can count on with the shop where you buy your bike. Helen's cares as much about servicing your bike and keeping you safe as it does about the sale of a new bike. Their tune-up packages and excellent repair service will keep your bike in perfect working order. Go to helenscycles.com. That's helenscycles.com. We're back at DISC in Marina Del Rey with spine surgeon Dr. Sanjay Khurana. So how do you explain to a potential person you're going to do surgery on what the risks are, and how do you live with that, knowing that one slight deviation could really harm someone? Because we're talking about the spine and spinal column.
Yeah, I think, I've been doing this now I'm coming on almost my 17th year, of practice, which is humbling in and of itself. And I remember once as a kid, my mom tells me a story how when I think I must have been no older than 8 or 9 years old, and I built a 6-foot ramp on the middle of the road, and I took my Schwinn bicycle and I sped up, and my mom and my sister were watching me, and I jumped off this ramp and I flew, and my mom was aghast. She didn't think I would do it. And I landed, and I was just really scared. I said, wow, I did that.
You landed on the bike.
I landed
upright.
On the bike, on the road, standing up. And I just looked backwards, and I said, what was I doing? I was crazy. And I think that when I think of that experience, it also reminds me of what I went through in the first 5 to 10 years of practice, or I'd say 5 to 7 years of practice at least. When I look backwards, I mean, you do this stuff. And now that I think I'm a little wiser and have a lot more knowledge and experience and understanding of what the complication profile is, sometimes you're like, wow, I got really lucky in those first 5 to 7 years. Even though I had the training and the basis for doing those things, sometimes you're wowed by your own ability to avoid complications and to get the surgery done in a safe way.
You landed the bike.
I landed the bike, the surgical bike. And even now, there's a well-known joint surgeon who gave us a grand rounds at Stanford, and one of the best joint replacement surgeons in the world. And he said, always pretend that you're a fellow. Never think that you know it all. And I think, for me, humility is the core of my success in being able to know my limitations, to know what I can do safely is the key for me. Now, it's this paradox, because as a surgeon, patients come to you needing confidence. And so you have to, you definitely don't want to exude waffling or, wishwashiness. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, you have to have that humility to make the appropriate decisions intraoperatively. You can, with small movements, you can make mistakes and they can have massive implications. And I think, the danger in what we do in our field is after you pass your boards, after the first 3 years of practice, and you think you really got a hold of things, and you're in your stride, right, after year 3 of practice. Well, that's when the danger can potentially occur, because now you have this kind of confidence that's not really based on really a lot except for several years in practice. So fortunately for me personally, in that window when I had this kind of potential, I don't know, undeserved confidence, okay. I avoided problems. But now, even 16, 17 years out in practice, I really am a complication avoider. That's just my, you know, and you get success sometimes by just simply avoiding complications.
I want to move on to your first job as a doctor, though. Tell me, how many years does it take you to become a well-trained spine surgeon?
Right. So from college, I took 4 years of medical school. Then I took 5 years of residency.
5 years of residency for the spine.
Then 1 year of spinal fellowship in Miami. So that was another, that was a total of 6 years. But I would argue that I didn't really learn spine surgery till I practiced for the first 3 years. And I think every spine surgeon would probably relate to that.
Yeah.
My first job that I took out of fellowship in Miami was a job in San Diego. And I actually took a vacancy at the Kaiser Permanente group in San Diego. It was an interesting situation because one of my really good friends from residency at Stanford, who trained, he did his fellowship at Stanford actually, was also looking for a job, and we ended up working together.
Oh, that's nice.
So the first year, my friend Steve Spizak and myself, we each probably did somewhere between 400 to 500 cases each in the first year.
That was some good experience.
It was excellent experience. It was, and we did it for 2 years, and we really enjoyed ourselves, and we learned a lot. Because very few surgeons can get that much experience in their under their belts
that quickly. Yeah. So then, how did you learn about DISC here in Los Angeles, and what led you to reach out to see if you could be part of it?
Right. So 2 years into practice at Kaiser, in that environment, there was a little bit of ceiling in terms of where I felt I could go professionally. I also had a little bit of an itch to come back to LA where my family was.
Sure.
I did look for jobs within the Kaiser system. I did look for jobs in different capacities. But one opportunity presented itself, which was Robert Bray, who is a well-known neurosurgeon in town, was starting this ambitious project where he was going to start mostly transitioning to outpatient spine surgery. And I had a reference point, and I basically touched base with him. And it was simply stated a new paradigm in spine surgery, yeah. Taking a surgery that's traditionally done in a hospital environment and doing it in a self-contained, physician-owned ambulatory space. And I'd never seen outpatient spine surgery in a freestanding ambulatory center. And so I saw it, and I immediately believed it.
Yeah.
You know, the techniques were a little bit different than what I'd been used to. There's much more leverage of the microscope than I had historically used in my training. And it was eye-opening, and I knew it could be done. And that's when my passion for this line of intervention kind of grew.
How many surgeries would you guess you performed by now?
So I've had to keep tabs on this ever since my Kaiser days. So I'm at about the high 4,000. So the number I had, my latest was about close to 5,000 procedures. So that's over about 16 years. So it's I do a consistent volume, and I've done it for a number of years now.
I just have to ask you about March of 2015, when you were playing golf on the Penmore golf course, and you saw an airplane crash. What did you see it crashing, or you just heard it when it did crash?
Yeah, that was that's like it happened yesterday. It's kind of funny, and that's my little 50 minutes of fame. So the Penmore golf course, which is right between here and Santa Monica, that day, it was a Thursday, as I recall, and I had finished a case early at St. John's, and I think one of my cases had canceled. So what better on a sunny day when come back to the office than to go to a golf course and, you know, play a quick nine hole. So on the seventh hole, as I recall, it was a short par four, kind of a 320-yard hole, I saw a airplane, actually, as we were walking to the green, head west. And as we chipped onto the green, the second shot, the airplane came back. And
how did you know it was the same airplane? Was it a distinctive color?
I looked up and it was quiet. There's just no noise. But I think my partners were looking up facing westward. So I looked up myself, and it was a little bit odd, but, you know, I'm not an airplane aficionado. For all I know, it was just glider. Uh-huh. And then, like a scene out of the Twilight Zone, it hit the tree right in front of us and plummeted to the ground from 100 feet plus directly down, a big thud. I was probably about 50 yards from the airplane, and I'm not sure exactly what I was thinking now that I really think about it, but I just straight-lined it to the airplane. Yeah, because
you were probably the first person who reacted, being a doctor
and dealing with trauma.
I
was there at the airplane. It was pretty macabre scene. It was a bad situation.
Saw a lot of blood.
It was pretty gory, and I was the only one there, and I didn't know what to do necessarily with no help. And then gas started leaking out, which was the scary thing.
Yeah.
So then I saw the gas on the floor, and we had to take him out. I mean, right away. Because I don't think there's a luxury to wait for EMS services.
Not when there's
leaking
gas.
Because I knew one cigarette butt, one little thing could light this thing up, and he would have been dead. So my golf partners, who I actually never knew, I just met him on the golf course. We all came together, and we took him out of this canvas harness.
It's only one person in the plane?
One person in the plane. Took him out of just carefully. I assumed he had a neck fracture and a back fracture, so I used all my kind of, you know, knowledge in the spine sector that I know.
Boy, was he lucky that you were there.
So yeah, it was a surreal experience. We just took him away from the airplane, primarily away from the gas of the fuel, because that was the main thing that on my mind.
So all four of you had to kind of stabilize.
Three of us, and we took him out. We kind of stabilized him.
When did you realize who it was?
Shortly after, you know, I was looking at his airway, doing the usual things just to make sure he was alive.
Was he conscious?
Yeah, he was conscious. Mm-hmm. When I was just trying to kind of orient myself to make sure he was breathing, you know, he had the airway intact. It was someone very recognizable. It was Harrison Ford. Mm-hmm. It wasn't pretty, but he was alive.
Was he speaking?
He was speaking. Mm-hmm. And shortly after we kind of immobilized him, the paramedics came. And fortunately, the airplane did not, you know, light up on fire. That was my biggest fears. And that 72 hours was a circus, you know, from a media standpoint. It became quite crazy.
Yeah, because how often does somebody crash a plane and have a spine doctor there to help pull them out of the airplane?
It was surreal. I mean, it was, you know, first of all, it just would never in my wildest imagination anticipate that to happen in the first place. And then have someone like, you know, a celebrity and it creates this, you know, media,
you know, frenzy.
I know. And so I got calls from the Today Show and all sorts of things to do promotions. And
you were there and everybody wanted to hear about it. Just like I wanted to ask you about it. You
know? So, I mean, it's fun. Then he came, to his credit, I mean, he came back, he was not in good shape, and I was worried about him. I actually checked up on him through his agent and made sure he was okay in the hospital. So, then he came back to clinic and he looked like a million bucks. He thanked me for, what I'd helped him with. And, he was just a gentleman. It was really nice to hear from him, and he looked amazing. He is really a true Superman.
Great story. So what would you foresee in the future? If you look 5 years ahead, 10 years ahead, can you see things coming down the road that you expect to show up eventually on your radar?
So, yeah, I think endoscopic spine surgery is probably real and probably going to be here to stay. That's using little cannulas, even smaller incisions, you know, kind of percutaneous arthroscopy type incisions.
So rather than doing an open procedure of making an incision, you're putting little puncture sites and looking in with a camera.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right now, if you look at our average microdiscectomy, it's probably about a half inch to 3/4 inch incision. So it's a tiny thumbnail size incision. Mm-hmm. There may be a time when we do these things through little portals. The incision length will probably be the same, but the question really is it less invasive or not? The knee lends itself to arthroscopy because there's a capsule. The spine doesn't really have a capsule, so it's not an apples-to-apples comparison. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. I don't think that's really panned out yet. The other really exciting thing in our field is the advent of robotic surgery. So there's machines that direct pedicle screw trajectories.
Describe what that is.
So a lot of times when we're doing these treatments for scoliosis or spondylolisthesis, we do, under the complicated terms, we put screws in the bones. And the bones we put them in are called pedicles. They're the structures that connect the vertebra, the vertebral body, mm-hmm. To the back aspect of the bone. So there's a nice little nature-made tunnels called pedicles, and we take advantage of these to put the screws in.
So that you're stabilizing the vertebra so there's no movement where you don't want movement.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And the problem with humans are that we can make mistakes. You know, you can have a screw thread that breaches out of the pedicle. These robots use intraoperative X-ray and CT scan as well as preoperative planning to put these screws in perfect position all the time. And that's at least the concept. The majority of urologists, I think most urologists as an example, is a completely different field. When they're doing prostatectomies or bladder surgery, if you look at 20 years ago, the most common urologist did it open, incision open. Then you look about 15 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, most people use laparoscopy, right. Cameras in the abdomen and reconstructing. I think if you look now, the majority of cutting-edge urologists are using robots. And in fact, the majority of them will not do a case without a robot, right? It's going to create another problem in the future where I think, as an example for urology, I think the next set of teaching residents and people that come out aren't going to have exposure with traditional ways of doing surgery. Mm. So it's like, you know, not being able to land a airplane manually. But in our field, in spine surgery...
That's a good analogy.
Yeah, exactly. You need to know that.
Yeah.
And I feel, you know, I still feel at heart I'm very young. And I think I am technically very mm-hmm. young.
Biologically, I'm pretty sure you're very young.
but I've been doing it for a long time. And so I think when I look at my peers in the city, I'm definitely that middle group. I'm not on the younger end. I'm definitely not on the older end. But I'm kind of mid-career, I'd say, mm-hmm. mid-youngish career. Mm-hmm. But I think it doesn't... I think to position myself for my patients, I think it's good to embrace all technologies and not ever poo-poo anything. Because I think, as an example for the robotic knee replacements and hip replacements, I think the data is not necessarily in it can't be done manually. You know, if someone's done hundreds or thousands of these, yeah. It's the question is a robot going to make the outcome superior over the long run? Are you putting the implants in just the best position so the longevity of that joint is going to be loaded perfectly for the longest period of time? And that's what the data is going to show over the next, you know, years. Is it economically effective or not? Is it helping people or not? Is it just a gimmick? Or is it going to be longstanding, you know, kind of reproducible technique that people are going to adopt and insurance companies and consumers are going to want? In spine surgery, I think the next field is going to be, you know, these robots are going to be doing the decompressions and doing all this stuff for us. I don't think I have any doubt in my mind it's going to happen. It will definitely happen. The question is how quickly it's going to happen.
And at first, it's going to be a surgeon observing and being in the room and supervising it, so to speak. But can you ever foresee a time when a robot marches in and introduces itself and does the surgery?
No, I think there'll be a physician involved at all times for supervision.
Yeah.
But I don't think the robot's going to introduce it, him or herself to the patient. I think it's just going to be a technical machine that you lay on. It does the work. But it's exciting. I think anything that's going to improve patient outcomes and is going to be better for mankind.
Well, I think you are definitely working on making all patient outcomes better for mankind. And I want to thank you so much for taking so much time to talk with all of us at Meet the Doctors.
Of course. My pleasure.
You've been listening to spine surgeon Sanjay Khurana. If you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode as we speak with the brightest minds in medicine, research, surgery, and much, much more. I'm Linda Huey. You can tweet to me on Twitter at Linda Huey. That's LyndaHuey. Say hi or tell me who you'd like to hear on Meet the Doctors. Thanks to production assistant James Cowan and to Tom Struther for audio post-production.